Cyrus Murchison took his shiny carriage to the California Central Building on Market Street as he would any other day. But there he found himself compelled to beat a hasty retreat far sooner than he had anticipated. He arrived at the railroad yard office short of breath, his usual impeccable clothes in disarray.
Get everyone aboard at once.
Horses are already loaded, Mr. Murchison.
Excellent. Did you send for my bay?
Chief Grange arranged for that. Oh, and Mr. Hobson and Mr. Huntley are waiting in the drawing room of your car, sir.
Good, I'll join them. Heck, get this motley collection of ne'er-do-wells aboard. Did you arrange for food?
I did, and whiskey too.
Well, keep a lid on that. We don't need a load of drunken protectors.
Any attempt to trail Cyrus Murchison through the early morning rush of people on the way to work was going to be useless. Smoke Jensen announced that conclusion to the others as they stood in the alleyway behind the California Central building. He then offered an alternate approach.
Odds are he's headed for the train yard. We can go directly there or try to find if his partners in this are still around. I say we do the latter.
That received a quick agreement and the four hunters set out. At the offices of Hobson's Mining Company, they learned that he was not in and had sent word that he would not be in that day. In the dockyard office of Huntley's Maritime Shipping Company, one of those newfangled telephones jangled on the desk of the receptionist. He looked at it aggrievedly and assured them that Mr. Huntley had telephoned early to say he would be out of town for a few days.
They're all at the railroad. We'd best get over there.
They rode at what speed they could through the throng of milling pedestrians, all to no avail, they soon discovered. Reluctant to make any answer, the yardmaster had a change of heart. Smoke Jensen used one big hand to bunch the bib of the man's striped railroad overalls and lift him clear off the ground.
You just missed them. Mr. Murchison and his associates had a special made up. They had a whole lot of rough-looking characters rolled out of here not 15 minutes ago.
Headed which way?
I don't reckon I should tell you that.
Smoke gave him a shake and got his face down close to that of the other man.
I reckon you better, or I'll have these fellas string you up by the ankles, and I'll slit your throat and let you bleed out like a sheep.
East! They went east on the main line, clear to Carson City in Nevada territory.
Why, thank you, Mr. Yardmaster. We're obliged. When's the next train that goes that way?
Well, not until tonight. The local leaves at 5 o'clock to pick up freight along the run.
Won't do. See what you can do about rustling up another train to take us right now.
But that's impossible. Running one train right behind the other is too dangerous.
Suppose you let me worry about danger. Are there cars and a locomotive in the yard now?
Well, yes, of course, but...
But nothing. Like I said, we'll worry about any danger. Where'd we find a likely train?
Out there.
Smoke thought on it for a minute.
Quo, you and Lewis go scout out a train that'll suit us. Let me know pronto.
After they left, he turned back to the hapless captain.
I see you got one of Mr. Bell's squawk boxes. I think we'll just take that along with us. That telegraph key, too. That way, if you get the urge to send word down the line and warn Mr. Murchison about us, you'll have a hard time doing it.
But that's railroad property.
So's the train we're taking.
Quo Chung Wu returned, excitement lighting his face.
We found one. A locomotive tender baggage car and stock car. Lewis said that they were just making it up.
What's Lewis doing?
He's keeping the engineer and fireman peaceful. Also, making them back up to a chair car.
Now that's nice. But we can do without the extra weight. It'll only slow us down. Run tell Lewis to forget it. We'll be with you shortly.
After Quo departed, Brian Pullen offered some advice.
Whatever we do, word will get out fairly soon. Even tied up, when the yardmaster is found, he'll spill everything.
Well then, we'll take him along. If he's not to be found, everyone will assume he's off on some business.
I ain't going.
That's what you think.
10 minutes later, they boarded the train. The yardmaster cowered in one corner of the baggage car. Quo remained in the cab of the locomotive to, as he put it,
to keep the engineer and fireman honest.
This he did with tai chi kicks and painful pressure holds. With a nervous eye on the young Chinese, the engineer opened the throttle and the train steamed out of the yard. Once underway, Smoke settled down for a strategy session with Lewis and Brian.
There's not a hell of a lot we can do except chase after him. At full throttle, we could close the distance given time.
And then?
Smoke frowned, considering it. He was no expert on trains, even though he had worked for the Denver and Rio Grande as a right-of-way scout. He visualized the exterior of the locomotive that pulled them.
There's a walkway along both sides of the boiler on our locomotive. I reckon we can use that to board the other train. When we do that, what we have to do is take on Murchison and his partners, without their hard cases mixing in.
Easier said.
Do not despair. Once in that private car, we can jam the doors at both ends so no one can enter. That'll make our task much easier.
What if there's a nest of them in there already?
That is for Smoke and myself to deal with, no? For that matter, you do quite well with that shotgun. Kuo Chung Wu is, Kuo Chung Wu. He may as chew firearms, but the truth is, he's a weapon himself. We will do all right.
I hope you are right.
Sally Jensen sat on the porch of her small home. She still had that nervous feeling in the pit of her stomach. She just couldn't seem to shake it. Smoke was in trouble.
Oh, Susan, don't you cry. Oh.
She looked up just then, and to her surprise and pleasure, she saw Monty Carson cantering up the lane from the far-off main gate to Sugarloaf.
I've heard from Smoke. He telegraphed to say he was about to wind up his business in San Francisco. Should be home in a week.
When did it come, Monty?
This morning. I come out right away once I seen it.
Oh, thank you. I just know everything will be all right now.
Cyrus Murchison set down the brandy decanter and offered glasses to Titus Hobson and Gaylord Hunter. They had just finished a sumptuous dinner at noon in the dining room of Murchison's private car. Over coffee and rolls that morning, Murchison had explained the current situation to his partners in crime. Since then, Titus Hobson had complained about the moderate speed of the special train.
Can't go any faster. The Daylight Express is ahead of us by only half an hour. The slightest delay for them would result in a disaster when we rear-ended the other train.
Hobson frowned.
Can't word of an unexpected halt be sent to us by telegraph?
There's no such thing as wireless telegraphy. Won't ever be. One has to be attached to the wire to get a message. So we run in the blind.
Did you send along word of our special?
Of course I did.
Then we could get flagged down in case of trouble, right?
True, but the faster we're going, the longer it takes to slow down and stop. Relax. Enjoy your brandy. There's no one chasing us. At least no one who can go as fast as we're going now.
Well, what do we do now?
Murchison frowned. He had never seen this yellow streak in the mining magnate before. Because he carefully chose the word he wanted.
We go as far east as we need to. Lie low, wait and see if anything is done efficiently. Actually, there's nothing that can be done. Only the three of us know what we have in mind. I assure you, Jensen and Longmont have no idea where we are going. They are our only enemy. When we have a chance to regroup, we'll strike back at them. And believe me, the consequences for Jensen and Longmont will be dire indeed.
A few miles back in the pirated train, Smoke sat with Lewis. The question he had left unspoken so far came to him now.
Lewis, what brought you to San Francisco in the first place?
A certain situation had become untenable for me in New Orleans. You know I had invested extensively in certain establishments in the Vieux Car, restaurants, casino, another casino on a riverboat. In fact, I had overextended. We had a run of heavy losses. Money became tight. One individual in particular, who sought to gain control of my businesses, pressed hard. He became obnoxious over it. Silly as it may sound, I found myself forced into an affair of honor with him. Dueling has been outlawed since the recent unpleasantness, one of the gifts of Reconstruction. In spite of that, we fought, and I killed him. Fortunately, I was exonerated. I later found out this man worked as an agent for Cyrus Murchison of San Francisco. Digging deeper, I found out about Murchison's grand scheme. It appeared he could not be content with Central California. He wanted to expand. So I came here to find out all I could.
Well, why didn't you tell me this from the get-go?
Because I'm convinced I behaved so foolishly. Like a 23-year-old who still believes he's immortal. What could I do alone against such powerful men?
So you contacted me.
Only after I learned much of the scope of their plans. 3 days later, Francie was killed. I knew I had to see it out. I loved that woman, mon ami. She was truly une belle femme. We set her up in that lavish establishment, do you remember? It was after you got her out of that tight spot in Denver.
Only so well, my friend. And I agree. Francie was indeed the lovely lady. She deserved much better.
Smoke turned to look out the window. Fields ripe for the harvest flashed past as the train gained speed. A short conference earlier in the day with the reluctant engineer provided him the information they would reach the town of Parkville shortly after noon. Smoke wondered what they would meet there. When the special slowed to a stop at the depot in Parkerville, Heck Grange prevailed upon Cyrus Murchison to give the men in the chair cars an opportunity to stretch their legs. With permission granted, they began to climb from the train. At once, Heck Grange spotted a familiar face.
Tyrone Beal!
Beal turned, then headed his way. Before Beal could speak, Grange pushed on.
You were supposed to be back in San Fran on the midnight flyer.
I know, only there was some delay. Some Hicktown sheriff got on our case about the fire and the dead man at the freight company. By the time he could verify our identity as railroad detectives, I missed the train. What the hell's going on here?
Oh, we could have used you in town. One hell of a fight with Longmont and his friend Jensen. Old Cyrus Murchison's got some wind up his sail. It seems he thinks these two are chasing after him. He wants to fall back and regroup. You and those others might as well throw in with us for now.
Glad to. No, except for Monk Diller, the rest ain't worth a pinch of coon crap.
Bring who you see is best, then. And after you get them on board, come back to Mr. Murchison's car.
In 5 minutes, hat in hand, Tyrone Beal was in Murchison's private car. Murchison sat behind a large, highly polished rosewood desk. Hobson and Huntley were in wingback chairs to either side.
Ah, Mr. Beal, I'm sure Gaylord here is anxious to hear your report.
Yes, sir. We got that farmer all right. Burned his freight office to the ground, pounded on him hard enough to get some sense into him, too. Well, actually, he got a bit much of a pounding, and, he died.
Oh, too bad. At least that's one gnat out of our faces. You do good work, Mr. Beal.
Thank you, sir.
You can do some more for us. I have only this minute learned from the station master that the lines are all dead west of us. The telegrapher received only part of a message that spoke of a runaway train headed this way. It is my belief that Longmont and Jensen and whatever ragtag band of vigilantes they could round up are in pursuit of us. I would be obliged if you took some of Heck's men and set up a delaying action. It would mean a considerable bonus for you if you succeeded.
You can count on me, Mr. Murchison. We'll hold them, never you mind. Hold them long enough to get away.
Fine, I'm counting on you. Now, I rather think we should be on our way. You pick your men and good luck.
45 minutes later, the commandeered train commanded by Smoke Jensen rolled into Parkerville. Nothing seemed untoward at first glance. 5 boxcars stood coupled together on 1 of 3 sidings. On the other side, beyond the double tracks of the main line, a passenger car idled, attached to a standard caboose. Like a suckling pig, the locomotive nosed up to the water tank and took on precious liquid. Firemen hurled wood aboard the tender, aided by Kuo Chung Wu and the brakeman. Relieved to be out of their cramped quarters, if only for a little while, Smoke Jensen, Lewis Longmont, and Brian Pullen walked out the kinks and stretched legs at an angle from a wooden slat bench.
Shit! Ambush!
Hot lead flew swift and thick. Trapped in the open, Smoke Jensen and his companions had no choice than to duck low and return fire. Smoke concentrated on the open door of the boxcar. Lewis Longmont quickly duplicated Smoke Jensen's efforts. Then, from the opposite side, away from the supposedly trapped quartet of Avengers, came the sound of steel wheels and rolling cracks. Light shone through the opening doors. Moments later, the hard cases left by Heck Grange deserted their vantage points, which had suddenly become hot spots. Kuo Chung Wu soon became frustrated with his inability to close with the enemy enough to be effective. Turned to Brian Pullen.
How do you use one of those?
Quo nodded toward Brian's six gun.
Best use one of these. Beginners do better with a shotgun.
Grinning, Quo hefted the weapon, shouldered it, squeezed the trigger. Nothing happened. Brian shook his head in frustration.
You have to cock the hammer first. Then, when you fired both barrels, open it with that lever. Clean the barrel. Take out the spent shells and replace them with fresh.
Oh, yes, I see. Thank you. Oh, I think I have it now.
I suppose you do.
The companion's withering fire quickly evened up the odds, leaving only four gun hogs. Smoke Jensen zeroed in on one.
Get back on board! Get this thing moving!
Smoke remained as a rear guard while the other men hustled onto the train. At that moment, a burly figure stepped out of the depot, a smoking six gun in one hand.
I want you, Jensen. I'm gonna take you down hard.
I'm not in the mix.
What? What? Why, you bastard? You got a gun in your hand, Jensen. Use it!
If I do, you'll die, whoever you are.
Slowly and deliberately, Smoke holstered his Colt.
My name's Tyrone.
Who cares?
Smoke quickly boarded the already moving train and settled down in the baggage car. Rolling through the peaceful autumn countryside, Cyrus Murchison was almost able to forget that he'd been forced to flee an empire he believed to have firmly in his grasp. At least he did until those meddling sons of mangy dogs interfered. Titus Hobson had told him that Smoke Jensen was a one-man army. Ruefully, he recalled that he had scoffed at that. He knew better now. Louis Longmont, who was considered to be a dandy and a fop, had proved far tougher than anticipated also. How did a New Orleans gambler get to be so accomplished a shootist? If he moved in company like Smoke Jensen, he must be one of the best gunmen in the country. And that little snit pulling. Until now, Brian Pullen had been the least feared lawyer in San Francisco. Where the hell did he learn to fight like that? Where did he learn to shoot? The way the three of them had gone through the Tong gangs impressed Cyrus Murchison. For all his fine education and refined manners, he actually preferred using raw brute force to accomplish his goals. As a boy, he had dominated his friends, always been the one to decide what games they played. Later, when away from home at school, Cyrus had been fiercely competitive. He would brook not the slightest error in the work of his lab or his student engineering partners. When at home during the summer, he worked with his father on the Union Pacific and frequently used his superior intellect, fast reactions, and utter fearlessness to knock resentful Gandy dancers and their underlings into line. Yet here he sat in his private car, running away from a fight. The mere thought of it infuriated him. A burning indignation rose within his chest, and he decided to change his tactics. At their last stop, a fragmentary message had caught up to him. It told enough. The men pursuing him had not been stopped at Parkerville. Beale had failed, and he was dead in the bargain. Cyrus pounded a fist on the arm of his chair in frustration. From now on, Jensen and Longmont would have to pay for every inch of track they gained. For the past hour, the commandeered train had been climbing a barely perceptible upgrade. The foothills of the Sierra Madre lay ahead. To keep up to the top speed safety would allow consumed far more fuel. The engineer conveyed that to Quo Chong Wu, who relayed the message via a pulley and rope device rigged between the baggage car and cab. Smoke Jensen replied that the train was to stop at the next station and take on all the wood it could hold. When the train with the four Avengers aboard arrived at Grass Valley, all appeared peaceful and serene. Only the engineer recognized a familiar car on the end of a train on the main line alongside the depot. Suddenly, a switch was thrown, and their stolen train rolled onto a siding, and all hell broke loose. From three parlor cars, a torrent of lead blasted towards the three-car train. After the first stunned moment, Smoke Jensen saw that none of the rounds seemed aimed at the stock car. Relieved for the safety of the horses, he concentrated on returning fire. At once, a hard case in the window of a chair car went down behind a shower of shattered glass. Up ahead, Smoke caught a quick look at the switch. A red ball atop the upright told them that the switch was set against them. Fully occupied with suppressing the volume of incoming rounds, he hadn't the time to scribble a message and send it to Quo. Fortunately, the thick, heavy desks used for sorting mail successfully absorbed the bullets flying through the doorway. It became a very dangerous waiting game. When at last the baggage car of the slowing train rolled past the lead passenger car of the other train, Smoke seized the chance to write a brief note.
Quo, send the switchman to throw the switch and let us through.
Smoke affixed it to the signal cord on the far side of the train and ran it forward. He didn't expect to fly if he didn't get one. Meanwhile, the thugs on the other train were trapped in the coach behind the baggage car. Just a lull came in the firing. Smoke steeled himself in what he knew must come next. He alerted his companions. First to reach the ladder, one thug clambered toward the cab. For his efforts, he received a foot in the face that broke his nose and jaw. Six guns crashed and bullets spanged off the metal walls and roof of the cab. The momentary delay had given Quo time to dodge below the protecting wall of metal beside the cringing engineer. Quo looked at the terrified railroad employee with disdain. If one could not conquer fear, one could never fully know oneself. Outside, the situation quickly changed. Covered by fire from both, one of the remaining hard cases climbed the ladder. A hand holding a six-gun came above the steel plates of the cab flooring first. Quo saw it and shifted position. When the hatless head slipped up next, Quo set himself and aimed a deadly full-thrust kick. A rifling six-gun took up the defense, and a withering fire came from the riveted car that rapidly thinned the ranks. It slowed and then halted the advance. From their exposed position, most of the hard cases saw no advantage in rushing men barricaded behind thick counters. Several made to withdraw. A sudden ragged volley came from both sides of the track. It slashed into the armed longshoremen and railroad police caught between the trains. From all sides of the train yard came a group of ragged farmers and train workers. Apparently, they had received a telegram that Smoke had sent earlier, apprising them of the situation. Apparently, they had agreed that Cyrus Murchison was a bad seed that needed to be rooted out.
What the hell is this?
Titus Hobson peered from the window, the red velvet curtain held aside in his rough hand.
Well, it would appear to me that your local farmers and merchants have failed to be cowed by the thugs you sent out here, Cyrus.
A bullet hole appeared in the window out of which Gaylord Huntley gazed.
Are you injured, Gaylord?
No, but it was a close call. Let's get the hell out of here.
Cyrus Murchison cut his eyes to Heck Grange.
Get those men back on board!
Reluctantly then, he reached for the signal cord after Grange left for the observation platform. Only then did an expression of abject relief cross the face of Gaylord Huntley. Some of the color returned to the features of Titus Hobson, too, who reached for the brandy decanter with trembling fingers. Cyrus Murchison covered his face with an unsteady paw.
God damn you, Smoke Jensen.
Agatha Murchison read with horror the bold black headline of the Afternoon Chronicle. Her heart was fluttering in her breast.
The railroad police and tongs fight it out.
Was this the problem that had taken Cyrus from home and office? His police minions had clashed with those heathen Chinese. His life must be in danger. Tears stung Agatha's eyes. She didn't want to read further, but she knew she must.
Late last night, elements of the California Central Railroad Police clashed with members of the secret societies of Chinatown, variously called the Tongs or Triad Society. Much bloodshed resulted. More than 20 men died in the conflict, with 100 more injured. Listed among the dead was an ominous figure known as Zhang Wai Li, reputed Triad Society leader. When the smoke cleared, no sign could be found of the railroad police or of the sinister foreign gangsters of the Tongs. Attempts early this morning by the Chronicle to contact Chief Hector Grange of the Central California Police elicited the information that the chief was not available. Likewise, attempts to reach Silas Murchison, president of the California Central Railroad, proved fruitless. Sources in the railroad services stated that Mr. Murchison had left the city on business and was not expected back for several days. Our Chinatown contacts responded with terse replies of no comment. The Chronicle's Chinatown reporter, Robert G., informed us that a sect of Buddhist priests were also attacked by the Tongs. We have often spoken out against vigilantism in our fair city, and this time is no exception. However, until we learn the motivation behind this most recent outbreak of citizen violence, we must reserve judgment. Yet duty clearly calls for this newspaper to demand an investigation.
Agatha laid aside the fiery words of the editorializing journalist and swallowed to banish the tightness in her throat. Something became undeniably clear to her sharp mind. If whatever had compelled Cyrus to order his police into Chinatown had been a legitimate reason, he would have had no reason to go into hiding. Unless, of course, there had been some... She couldn't use the word criminal. Had there been something unlawful about the association of her husband with those Chinese? Suddenly, she went cold and still. Hadn't that one in the article that Zhang Weili been right in this very house not long ago? Slowly, she lowered her head and covered her face with hands that trembled. Well, hadn't he? As the battle came to a close, Smoke Jensen hopped out of the mail car. He looked at the ragged group of men that had come to his aid.
Well, boys, what can I say? Thank you all. Now, jump aboard. We're going to take this fight straight to the man himself.
The men quickly jumped aboard the train. Eagerness was painted all over their faces. When Murchison's train began slowly to gain momentum, Smoke Jensen went forward and swung up into the cab. His stern, powder-grimed face struck pure terror in the heart of the engineer. Not a man to show yellow before anyone. But with the muzzle of Smoke Jensen's peacemaker jammed against his head, he decided now would definitely not be the damn time to show undue bravado.
I want you to explain to my friend here how to throw that switch when the train clears it. Don't steer him wrong, or you'll answer to me.
The man merely shook his head in terror. At once, he began to outline the steps to activate the switch. Kuo Chung Wu listened intently, then dismounted and ran forward. By then, Murchison's special had cleared the switch. Looking down, Kuo located the lever that swung the hinged tracks to give the siding access to the main line. Only minutes separated the two trains, and every second counted. Kuo raised the arm into the position described and heaved on it. The wrong way. Sweating, Kuo reversed his stance and pushed. Behind him, he heard the locomotive gather itself to rush forward. He stood upright and gave a friendly wave. Then, fists on hips, he waited for the stolen train to come to him. More time was lost to allow horses and volunteers to board. Then Kuo stepped aside to allow the locomotive to rumble past. When the grab iron came next to him, he reached out and swung aboard with all the ease of one who had had years of practice. He was surprised to see that Smoke Jensen had gone back to the bullet-riddled baggage car. Flame leaped from the open door of the firebox. Kuo gave a satisfied smile. They're going to catch up soon. Gaylord Huntley looked back apprehensively through the window, and greasy sweat popped out on his forehead.
Oh, my God, they're gaining on us.
Zach Burchard is a trustworthy man. We'll send word along the line. Up ahead, there's a siding just beyond a wide curve. When we reach it, we'll pull out onto it and throw the switch against them. I don't like wrecking a locomotive, but I'll do it if it stops those damnable gunfighters.
That's sort of costly, isn't it?
Cyrus Murchison revealed his anxiety in a flash. His fist pounded the edge of his desk.
Damn the expense! These men are not dolts! That they are on the verge of ruining us right now should prove it! We could still lose it all, gentlemen. I have an idea. I own this fine long-range hunting rifle. It has a telescope on it. You are such an excellent shot, Gaylord. Let's say you stop worrying and make yourself useful. See if you can pick off the engineer of that train.
I thought you just finished praising his loyalty.
I was talking about the station master at Grass Valley.
Doubt in his face, Gaylord Huntley turned away from his vigil and reached for the rifle. He pushed in the loading gate cover and checked that a round was ready to chamber. With care, he raised the muzzle to the ceiling and turned back to the platform door. his shoulders slumped in resignation. He opened the door and walked out on the observation deck. He knelt and brought the rifle to his shoulder. Careful, he eased the eyepiece closer and established a field. The sway of the train made it difficult to set the crosshairs on the head and left shoulder of the engineer. Satisfied, Huntley worked the lever action and chambered a long, fat 45-7500 express ram. Then he returned to his study at the target.
Steady. Steady. Lower now.
Easy. Oh, damn it!
Train lurched violently and destroyed his aim. Gaylord Huntley eased off the telescope and let the bright spot fade in his right eye.
Try again.
He fined his sight picture and elevated the muzzle. A second later, he saw the flash of a spark as the bullet whanged off the faceplate of the cab a foot above the open window. A quick glimpse through the scope revealed that the engineer had not even flinched. Quickly, he ejected the spent cartridge and chambered another. The next shot screamed along the outside of the boiler and burst into a shower of lead fragments when it hit the thick iron plate of the cab face. Quickly, he reloaded again. The fourth round went 2 feet wide of the cab when the private car hurtled sharply to the left as the speeding train swung into a curve. In his extreme frustration, Huntley failed to notice that in his absence, someone else had entered the cab of the locomotive behind him. He also did not observe that the newcomer held a Winchester Express like his own. Huntley took aim and took up the slack and the trigger. Then, through the circular rescale of the telescopic sight, he saw a lance of flame and a curl of smoke. Hot lead spanged against the brass cap of the platform rail and showered shards of metal into the face of Gaylord Huntley. Reflexively, he dropped the rifle and fell backward onto his butt. Beyond the rail, his tearing eyes took in another flash. Smoke Jensen lowered the Winchester Express from his shoulder when he saw the body of Gaylord Huntley sprawl backward in his death throes.
One less.
The chase continued, though the gap had rapidly closed. Hauling more cars, the lead locomotive could not maintain its distance advantage for long. At the suggestion of the suddenly and surprisingly cooperative engineer, whistled shrilled constantly, a tactic that Smoke Jensen thought would unnerve those they pursued. Torn snatches of answering screams came from sidetracked westbound trains as the two locomotives ran headlong through the foothills of the Sierra Nevada mountains. Train crews stared after them with eyes wide and mouths agape. Tediously, the distance shortened to half the original 1,000 yards. From there on, time was suspended as the trailing locomotive rushed toward the private car of Cyrus Murchison. Smoke judged it time to put his rough plan in motion. He left the baggage car to talk to the volunteers in the chair coach behind. The 24 farmers and townies who had jumped aboard Smoke's commandeered train gathered around now at his summons. He eyed them with concentration.
Now, this is going to be tricky. None of you are required to do what I'm going to ask. First off, I want to know how many among you consider yourselves sure-footed.
Nearly every hand went up. Smoke suppressed a smile and nodded.
Take a look outside and forward.
By turns, they went to the window and did so.
You see that catwalk along the boiler? How many of you sure-footed ones think you can walk that while the train is moving?
Smoke considered that with himself and Lewis and six of these willing volunteers, they could carry off his plan. It didn't matter what happened to the rest of the train. What they needed to do was isolate the rear cab containing Murchison and Hobson. Now, for the tricky part.
That's good. We need six men to come with Lewis and me. What we're going to try to do is close in and ram that observation car. The idea is to derail it.
Startled expressions broke out among the plain country folk facing Smoke Jensen.
Failing that, those of you who come with us are to be ready to advance along the catwalks on both sides of the locomotive and board the other train while we're in motion.
That's a tall order, mister.
Yeah. Why should we take such a risk for you? Besides, who are you anyway?
Folks call me Smoke Jensen.
Oh, Jesus, I've heard of you. Read all about you in them Ned Buntline books.
Buntline lies. I've never shot a man in the back who hadn't turned it after I squeezed the trigger. Now, like I said, Do you think you can walk that narrow track and jump if need be?
7 men nodded their heads solemnly.
Better than I expected.
Remember, there's still a lot of hard cases aboard that train. If we don't isolate the rear car, the fighting will be rough.
Only one of the hands went down.
All right, I'll lead you. Lewis here will give you the word when the time is right.
Now, Terence O'Brien did not mind shattering the nerves of those they pursued. Besides, he reasoned, and gave them more of a chance by warning approaching trains onto sidings. When he heard the blathering of that crazy man, he knew the boyo had slipped a cog somewhere. Jumping from one train to another, pure madness. And when the tough-faced Gilly ordered the throttle open to full again, he said as much.
That's a lunatic idea if I've ever heard one. Why, at the speed we're going, we could ram that train ahead of us.
Exactly what I had in mind.
Not with my beautiful baby, you won't. You'll derail us both.
The thought occurred to me. Only I want you to just knock them off the track, not us.
Can't be done. We hit them hard enough to derail that heavy car, we go off too.
You're the engineer. If you say that's the case, I believe you. Can you do this? Get us close enough that the men can jump from the front of this locomotive to the rear of that train.
Sure, easy. If anyone is crazy enough to try making the leap. Thing is, I don't want to ram them.
I understand. Only give it a try and see what you can do.
You are stork-raving crazy, you are.
Then, in exasperation, he put hand to throttle and shoved it forward. Gap quickly closed. At 200 yards, 4 men appeared on the top of the private car. 2 took up sitting positions while 1 knelt and the other flattened out prone. Smoke took note of it and hefted his express rifle. Aiming through the forward window opposite the engineer, Smoke squeezed off around. One of the seated hard cases reared backwards, fell to one side and rolled off the car. Smoke hunkered down and took aim again. He drew a bead on the chubby gun hand lying on his belly. At the bullet's impact, the fat hard case jerked upward and flopped back down, shot through the top of his head. Not bad, Smoke judged his performance. At the last moment, before Smoke could side in on him, the remaining 2 of Murchison's gunmen gave it up and ran for the safety of the car ahead.
All right, O'Brien, let's do this.
The distance between the 2 trains was now less than 100 feet. Gingerly, O'Brien brought his behemoth up to within 20 feet. Hand playing the throttle like an organist at a mighty pipe organ console. Smoke gave him the nod, swallowing against the lump of fear in his throat. The engineer opened the throttle again, and the big Baldwin 462 sped into the rear of the Bowman manufactured private car. Smoke staggered as the 2 vehicles slammed each other. The observation platform rail sheared off and went flying to the sides of the track. Murchison's car jolted forcefully, and the rear truck raised, then slammed back. Unasked, O'Brien eased back. The blunt nose of the locomotive withdrew from its menace over the beleaguered carriage and held steady, 3 yards off the shattered rear platform. Terence O'Brien looked pleadingly at Smoke Jensen. Smoke nodded to him.
Bring it in as close as possible. We'll jump.
Cyrus Murchison could not believe what he saw through the open door at the rear of his private car. Beyond the gap between it and the chase train, men stood on both sides of the locomotive boiler, slowly advancing to the nose of the steaming monster. He'd been knocked out of his chair by the collision. First, he couldn't figure out what those lunatics had in mind. Then, the reality struck him. They intended to jump from the speeding locomotive to his car, and if they made it, it would all be over. He waved to a slowly recovering Heck Brain.
We've got to get some of the men in here. Those crazy bastards are coming after us.
How?
They're going to jump over here, you idiot. Now do as I say. Get a dozen, no, 20 guns in here right now.
Heck started for the front door of the car. He worked the latch handle and passed through at an uneven gait. Wobbling on unsteady legs, Brain pushed into the next car. Concerned faces looked up. He stared him down, swaying with the roll of the car, one hand on the butt of his 6 gun.
We're in for it, boys. Jensen's coming after us. Gonna jump from train to train. The boss wants 20 of you in his car right now.
Hell, Chief, we can't get 20 men in there. Maybe 8 or 10. Even then, we'd be crammed so close, we'll be like shooting fish in a stock tank.
I know that, Miller. Best thing is to be ready on the vestibule in case those gun hawks get through. Mr. Mr. Murchison will never know if there's 20 or 5 in there. Now let's get going!
Smoke Jensen looked down at the dizzying blur of ballast and cross ties in the space between the cowcatcher, the Baldwin Loco, and the rocking platform ahead. He swallowed to regain his equilibrium, flexed his knees, and prepared to spring. A moment later, the Baldwin surged forward and Smoke hit the platform on hands and knees. He landed solidly, thankful for the gloves he wore. A burly farmer crashed to the platform beside him. Smoke looked up to see the car interior was empty. He came to his feet as two more men landed on the observation deck. A moment later, the door at the far end flew open. 5 men poured in. Smoke filled his hand with a .45. Lewis Longmont appeared at Smoke Jensen's side.
The last two are on their way.
Good. No chance to secure the door now. No reason, really. Murchison and Hobson got away.
They can't go far.
With the arrival of the last volunteers, the volume of fire became too much for the armed ruffians. Their ranks devastated, they chose to withdraw from the hail of lead that cut them down mercilessly. Smoke Jensen's last slug slammed into the thick wooden door of the private car.
I said we go ahead.
They'll be waiting for us.
Yep, I know. That's why I brought these.
From the pocket of his vest, Smoke produced half a dozen bright red packets, covered and sealed with tinfoil.
What are those?
Railroad torpedoes. I picked them up from the utility box in the cab of the other train.
What do you do with them?
We have one of these fine gentlemen toss them through the far door, one at a time, and shoot them like clay pigeons.
What good will that do, mon ami?
Enough explosive to jar the lead truck of a locomotive and be heard over the noise of the engine.
Powerful. What gave you the idea?
I learned about these torpedoes when I worked for the DNRG. When a train breaks down on the main line and there's no siding, a trace walker goes back half a mile and lays out a series of torpedoes. The number of bang tells the engineers what's wrong and prepares them to slow and stop his train. In the construction camp, we used to shoot them for sport, so I know it'll work.
Then by all means, let us get to it, my friend.
Smoke turned to the volunteers.
Any of you good at Abner Doubleday's game of baseball?
3 of the Valley men eagerly nodded their heads.
One of you consider yourself a good hurler?
I'm fairly good, Mr. Jensen.
Good then. Here, I want you to take these.
Smoke began explaining his plan to the pitcher. 2 minutes later, Smoke, Lewis, and Ole crossed the gap between vestibules and got ready. Lewis yanked open the door. Ole gave a slow underhand pitch that sailed one of the red torpedoes down the aisle, flat side toward the door. Smoke brought up his .45 Colt before the startled hard cases could react. At Smoke's nod, Ole pitched another one. A weakened portion of the sidewall, complete with blown-out window sash, ripped away from the side of the car. It whipped off along the rushing train. The gun hands who remained conscious could stand it no longer. Pandemonium broke out as they surged toward the next car forward. Smoke signaled to the waiting volunteers and led the way after the fleeing enemy. The survivors raced off to find security in the next car. Smoke watched as the last man through the entry paused to throw the lock and cut his eyes to Lewis.
We're gonna have to do this the hard way.
Smoke Jensen stationed 3 men at the vestibule door to keep the attention of the hard cases beyond. Then he and Lewis led the others to the rear of that car and out onto the narrow platform. He pointed to a set of iron rungs which led to the roof. With difficulty, they climbed the ladder, fighting against the jerk and sway of the careening train. On top of the car now, Smoke went forward with the volunteers following. Clouds had formed, Smoke noticed as he worked his way toward the car full of gunmen. A light misty rain fell, whipped into their faces by the rush of wind. The air smelled of wood smoke which gushed from the tall, grinder-fitted stack. It was filled with fine, gritty cinders and inky exhaust which quickly blackened their faces and clothing. Footing became treacherous on the damp strips of wood that formed the walkway. When they reached the gap between cars, Smoke stopped to consider the alternatives. Climb down, cross over, and climb back up, or jump. He tested his boot soles against the wood to gauge the security of the roof walk. He took a quick appraising glance at the strained faces behind him, Then he moved back toward him, took three quick running steps and jumped. At the last instant, his foot slipped. Smoke hurtled in an awkward sprawl toward the forward chair car roof. The toe of his boot caught on the trailing lip of the walkway and sent him to his hands and knees. After two long, worrisome minutes, he inched forward. Still challenging fire to come up through the roof, he paused again. Perhaps the idea didn't occur to those below that they could penetrate the thin roof of the car. Smoke pressed himself up onto his boots and motioned for the others to follow. To his relief, they made it without undue noise. When they had gathered as best they could, Smoke explained what he had in mind.
Spread out! We're gonna fire at random through the roof. May not hit anyone, but it'll stir them up some. The next coach is the smoking car. My bet is that Murchison and Hobson are in there. If we can rig the doors of the next car, jam them somehow, we can trap his gunmen there and go after the leaders with little risk.
Sounds good!
Let's get to it!
Smoke and Lewis went forward and climbed down. Two volunteers went down the nearer ladder. Smoke used a coupler release bar to tightly jam the latch to the parlor door. To his disappointment, they could find nothing to do the same to the rear entrance to the smoking coach. Accepting the setback, they returned to the top. Seconds later, bullets punched through the roof and sent showers of splinters and shards of the stamped tin ceiling down onto the unsuspecting gun hogs. Shots sounded from within the car, and shards of glass tinkled out onto the vestibule platform. Eager hands reached through to wrestle with the obstructing bar. After some furious struggle, it came free. Men sprang instantly across the smoking car. Smoke Jensen had no choice but to make the best of a failed plan, prepared to lead the volunteers.
Cut it loose! Cut it loose!
The familiar voice of Cyrus Murchison came from the open doorway to the smoking car. With a lurch, the couplers opened and the front part of the train sped away from the rear portion, which began to lose forward momentum. Smoke cut his eyes behind him and saw the chase locomotive swelling rapidly in size.
Get down and hold on!
Beyond Smoke, the second train plowed into the rear of the first. The forces of the impact telescoped along the line of cars. The momentum drove the open couplers together, momentarily reattaching the last three cars. The men clinging to the catwalk bounced and whipped about like rag dolls in the hands of an angry child. Steam exploded from the ruptured boiler of the trailing locomotive. Then, private car Cyrus Murchison left the rails, crumpling in on itself as it drove forward. Coach ahead teetered and began to lean to the left. It fell ponderously, domino-like. The next chair car began to cant to one side. Only the remaining forward motion of the reconnected cars prevented total disaster. The car under Smoke and his men began to waver.
Get off here! Jump to the right!
Unmindful of possible broken bones, the eight clinging men threw themselves away from the reeling car. The unsecured coupler twisted at the joint and separated. It let the car pitch over to one side. The skid had distanced before it came to a rest at an acute angle. Beyond them, the train with Murchison aboard rolled serenely away.
Oh, I think I broke my leg.
Hang on, I'll get you some help.
Smoke came to his boots and took stock of the disaster. He saw that the Baldwin had derailed on only one side, the lead truck of the tender dangling in empty space above the rails. Miraculously, the stock car had not jumped the track. Even more astonishing, the boiler did not explode. It hissed and belched steam and somehow remained intact. Lugged fists on hips, Smoke watched while Brian Pullen and the rest of the volunteers climbed shakily from the baggage car.
What the hell happened?
Murchison cut the rear of the train loose. You ran into it.
Well, hell's fire if that just don't beat all. What happened to Murchison?
They went on. Let's get those horses out and head after them. Chances are we've lost them for now, but we can try.
Pullen took stock of the destruction all around them.
I'm not sure that's a good idea.
Cyrus Murchison, acting as conductor, signaled the engineer to slow the train when he observed the marker indicating a curve and a side. Switchman dropped off the side and ran forward as the big 2440 American Locomotive Works mainliner slowed even more. He threw the switch and the bobtailed train rolled smoothly through the switch onto the side.
What are you doing?
We do not know if the other locomotive derailed, Titus. In light of that, we cannot take the chance of remaining on this train.
Cyrus turned to Heck Grange.
Offload mounts for everyone remaining with a spare, if possible. We'll go to Carson City by horseback. Think of it as a pleasant outing in the bracing mountain air, Titus. Come, we'll sleep in tents under the stars, feast on venison and bear, clear our lungs of the city's miasma, and commune with nature.
Now, I hardly think this is the time for levity, Cyrus.
Why not? If you cannot laugh at adversity, you're doomed. Don't you know that?
My God, you're priggish when you get philosophical, Cyrus.
Heck Grange's return took away a need for Cyrus Murchison to make a reply.
The horses are coming off now. We can leave in 10 minutes.
Good. We may not have that much time.
We're 10 miles from where we cut loose those cars. With luck, them and their rolling stocks are all busted up.
You're right, Heck. Only we can't rely on that.
So? Even if they get out of that mess, it'll take the better part of 2 hours to get here from there.
You're right, of course. See to everything, Heck. Be sure to offload those chests from the baggage car.
Grange left to see to the task. Murchison set to work poking into the drawers and shelves of the smoking car. He retrieved 2 boxes of excellent hand-rolled cigars made in Havana, 5 bottles of brandy, 10 sardines, cheeses, and other delicacies. He stuffed all of it into a hinged top box. Brandy he wrapped in bar towels. He looked up into the startled expression of Titus Hobson.
No need to deprive ourselves, is there, Titus? The amenities of life are what make us appreciate it.
Oh, it'll slow us down.
No more than the tents and other supplies I had the forethought to put aboard. 1 more pannier on the back of a pack horse will not hinder our progress.
Wait a minute, you anticipated this happening?
Nothing quite so drastic, old boy, but I did have grounds to suspect that all would not go smoothly. Come, we can make this small setback into a lark. How long has it been since you've been away from your wife's sharp tongue and those cloying children?
All right, Cyrus. I'll give you your due. This could turn out to be interesting.
Yes, but only if we hurry. Jensen and Longmont are still back there.
Shaken, though essentially unharmed, the volunteers who had joined Smoke Jensen and Lewis Longmont went about saddling horses. They prowled through the kitchen of Cyrus Murchison's ruined private car and provisioned themselves with a wide variety of expensive and exotic food. Smoke gathered them when everything had been gotten into readiness.
This is going to be rough. Those who have been injured or wounded should head back. There's no telling how long we'll be on the trail.
How far do you intend to go, Mr. Jensen?
All the way to Carson City, if necessary.
Then I'd best go back with the rest. My broken leg won't let me abide with damp ground and cold nights for that long.
Go ahead. No shame be on you. The rest of us will start off along the tracks. See if we can catch up to that train.
We'll leave a few men behind to delay them if they do come.
It'll only waste lives needlessly. Jensen's not dumb. You'll be looking for that. I reckon the place to lay an ambush is up around Piney Creek, just ahead of the upgrade of the Sierras.
Murchison considered that. He accepted that Heck Grange, with his war experiences with the Union Army, had a better grasp of tactics than himself. Yet he was loath to appear not to be entirely in charge. Now is not the time for banter, he reminded himself.
All right, let's do it that way.
They rode for 2 hours. Murchison's henchmen grumbled among themselves. The majority were city-bred and raised. At 3 o'clock, the big party reached the banks of Piney Creek. Cyrus Murchison had Heck Grange toll off 9 men to set up an ambush in the rocks and cluster of willows that lined the stream bed. None of the hard cases liked being left behind, yet the possibility of ending their ongoing problem appealed to most of them. They dug in, arranging stones and making dirt parapets in front of scooped-out hollows in the creek bank. When all met the approval of Heck Grange, he reported to Murchison.
We're ready. Might as well head out.
You've done a fine job, Heck. This should rid us of Jensen and Longmont. I'll sleep better tonight knowing that.
Smoke Jensen kept pushing the volunteers. At his own insistence, Lewis Longmont rode the drag to make certain they hadn't any stragglers. The afternoon seemed to have too few hours in it. Long red shafts of sunlight slanted through the broken overcast to warn of approaching evening. Smoke wanted to get as far along that trail as possible. He had not had any difficulty finding signs of what direction the fleeing men had taken. Heavy-laden pack horses had left deep gouges in the soft soil of the gentle slopes, and it seemed the inexperienced riders could not keep their mounts in a single file. Within 10 minutes of reaching the abandoned train, Smoke had an accurate count of the numbers they faced. It was more than he would have liked, yet far less than it started out. Now, he gave consideration to the 25 riders, and the possibility someone in charge might consider an ambush.
We'll stop here for a while. The map I found shows Piney Creek not far from here. The stream runs through the easiest pass leading to the high country. The creek would also make a good place for an ambush.
You are going to scout it out, I assume?
That I am, my friend. You're welcome to come along.
Perhaps next time.
I'll remember that.
I'll see to making camp. No fires, I assume?
No, Lewis. They're running from us. I doubt they'll turn back and attack. A cold camp won't make our friends very happy. It'll give them a chance to cook some of those fancy victuals they took from Murchison's private larder.
5 minutes later, he rode out in a circuitous route that would take him up the blind side of Piney Creek. Unseen by any of the neophyte woodsmen, Smoke Jensen slipped near the camp set up by those men in the ambush. The men were obviously from the city. He sat there staring into the fire, ruining their night vision.
Yeah, this is too easy.
Smoke moved like a snake through the underbrush, sneaking to within 5 feet of the camp. He stormed to his feet, drawing both his pistols at once.
Hello, boys. Time to go to hell.
Three men were left standing, but Smoke figured he had done enough damage for one night. He silently stole off into the night like a ghost. In the camp established by Cyrus Murchison, the main fire had died down to a low rose-orange glow of pulsating coals. Murchison sat with his back propped against the bole of an aged ponderosa pine. He had a half-filled body of brandy in one hand and an unlighted cigar in the other. He didn't want to let go of the liquor in order to light his stogie, though he dearly wanted the consolation of the rich smoke. An uneasy Titus Hobson approached.
Light me a strip of kindling and bring it, will you, Titus?
Hobson did as bidden, igniting the cigar. Then he sat down beside Murchison and reached for the bottle.
Those popping sounds we heard earlier? I have a feeling it wasn't caused by the weather.
Sorry to say I agree. Either those people chasing us stumbled into the ambush and it's all over, or...
Or they rode right over the men you left back there.